Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday morning. And in just a moment, we'll be talking with the author of The Limits of Power, which has gone way up on the New York Times bestseller list. I think over the weekend it was listed as number 3, which I'm sure is great news for our guest, who is the author of the book. Professor Andrew Bacevich will be joining us. He is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University, retired from the U.S. Army with the rank of colonel, and he will be looking at how it is that we're managing an empire and how empire came to be, which he says assumed the existence of bountiful reserves of power, economic, political, and cultural, but above all, military power in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War. Few have questioned that assumption. The status of the United States as a sole superpower appeared unassailable. We'll talk about how that came to be and how we are exerting power all over the world and why that's happening and should that happen and can we do everything. First, though, I'm here with Rhonda Fanning, who's the producer of this entire program. It's our fall membership drive, and we're here to ask your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. As you know, listener donations are the foundation of what we do. It's the foundation of our budget, and that's why we're asking for your gift right now. Make your pledge of support at WPR.org or toll free at 888-202-2552. Good morning, Rhonda Fanning, who's with me in the studio.
Hi, Kathleen. That's right. We have a goal this hour of $9,000, and I was just informed, very exciting news, that a group of existing members has agreed to give us an extra $1,000 when we meet that goal. So be the first one to call this hour. Make your pledge now online at WPR.org, or you can call toll-free at 888-202-2552.
And as you know, you're all listeners who are readers, and as a special incentive, a thank you gift, when you donate $150, you can receive a copy of Professor Bacevich's book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. That's just for this hour, $150. We're happy to send this to you.
This is how Wisconsin Public Radio operates. We ask you to become a member. When you contribute, your financial support makes this radio station and this program possible. Over 40,000 people currently support Wisconsin Public Radio through their donations. Thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, you can call now and become a member.
You sure can. Make the decision to do so right now. You depend on hearing great programs on Wisconsin Public Radio. We bring them to you day after day. Now make a contribution, please, to support this program. All you do is go to WPR.org and pledge securely online or call toll-free at 888-202-2552. And just for this hour, the book that has received so much attention all over the country and probably all over the world because it's about world power is Andrew Bacevich's book for $150 pledge, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, which looks at all of the crises facing America today, the economy, which can't be fixed by relying on expansion abroad, the government, who our guest says has been transformed. The government has been transformed by an imperial presidency, and what we have is a democracy in form only. It will be sure to get you thinking, and that's for a pledge of $150. Professor Andrew Bacevich is with us now. He is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University, retired from the U.S. Army with the rank of colonel, also author of The New American Militarism. He's written for Foreign Affairs, The Atlantic Monthly, The Nation, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Wall Street Journal, and he's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. We'll be welcoming your phone calls to participate in our discussion today as well, and that number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Professor Bacevich, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on your program.
You talked early in your book about the words peace dividend, and I haven't heard those after saying them on the radio for so long. I don't even remember what that was. We haven't heard peace dividend in a long time, but we sure had great plans for it, didn't we?
Well, briefly, some of your younger listeners probably have never even heard that phrase.
Mm-hmm.
But as the Cold War was winding down, this great crisis that had extended across decades. At that particular moment, there were voices heard in Washington that said, gosh, now that this thing is coming to an end, maybe we should spend less on sort of military things and perhaps attend more to domestic priorities. That idea got nipped in the bud, and I think the key explanation was the Persian Gulf War of 1990-91, another national security emergency that began as soon as the Cold War ended, and an emergency that had its own conclusion in Operation Desert Storm end up persuading many Americans that, gosh, military power was actually a pretty good thing. So who needs a peace dividend? What we want to do is to exploit this advantage that we have and remain the world's sole superpower.
Mm-hmm. How do we define ourselves? You talk a lot about democracy and how we use it in terms of finding friends and going to war with people to impose democracy. Let's just look at this shining light of democracy that has been the reason that we're supposedly in Iraq. Who knows why we're there exactly? But it's this idea that everybody should be like we are.
Well, I mean, you're raising a tremendously important and complicated issue. I would urge people not to respond to democracy talk coming from Washington by assuming that it's completely and totally cynical. I don't believe it is. I personally believe, you know, it's hard to see into someone's heart, but I personally believe that after 9/11, President Bush did undergo something akin to a religious transformation and came to be a true believing Wilsonian who bought into the proposition that America has a great mission to the rest of the world to spread freedom. I would also insist, of course, that this mission, whether particularly with President Bush or with any of his predecessors, the mission seems to become alive at a time when the interests of American power are served by asserting ourselves in some part of the world or around the world. So it is both that the notion of spreading freedom becomes part of the justification, becomes part of the sort of the moral, the sort of gives a moral legitimacy to our policies. But in another way, it also serves to obscure what are the more substantive explanations for our behavior.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the management of what we're doing now, which you have talked about as an empire, really, assumes that we have. And boy, today is a case in point with the incredibly volatile stock market, and it's going crazy again today, that we have huge reserves of power, that we have economic, you break it down, economic power, political power, cultural power, but above all, military. That's a lot on the plate, isn't it?
Well, I think that this comes out of that moment at the end of the Cold War, and then when the Cold War sort of intersects with the first confrontation with Saddam Hussein. People in Washington, many people, I think, in sort of the intellectual policy world, interpreted the end of the Cold War as an American triumph, an American victory, that the Soviet Empire collapsed because of what we did. I personally think that was a misperception. The Soviet Empire collapsed internally. It was factors internal to that empire that really were decisive. Nonetheless, people came away from this moment of the late 1980s and early 1990s and began to introduce a vocabulary into our political discourse, you know, of the end of history, sole superpower,
right,
indispensable nation, unipolar moment. And there was such a tremendous amount of sort of triumphal chest beating that people began to believe that there really were no limits to American military power, economic power, and political influence. That was a delusion. That delusion managed to survive the 1990s, but it has not. It should not survive the events of the last 7 years.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we're at a time where everything seems to be falling apart. Some will say that Iraq is a little bit better than it used to be, but certainly the amount of money we're spending for what we're getting, a lot of people are saying, is it worth it?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I mean, even if you want to make the case, let us stipulate for the sake of argument, I don't believe this, but let us stipulate for the sake of argument that we are on the road to victory in Iraq. Well, what will victory give us? I mean, you put your finger on the core issue, I think, that we will have spent an enormous amount, probably upwards of $1 trillion at least, not to mention lives lost, lives shattered. And for what? Is the fact that Saddam Hussein is gone a good thing? Of course it is. But getting rid of Saddam and liberating the Iraqi people, those were not really the primary reasons for invading Iraq in the first place. The idea, and there are plenty of on-the-record comments to this effect, the idea was to begin in Iraq a project of transforming the Islamic world. And it seems to me very clear that to try to transform the Islamic world by invading and occupying and then rebuilding countries is a proposition that is utterly unaffordable. And to continue down that path will necessarily result in our bankruptcy. And again, you've made about three references to the market collapsing. I mean, we may reach bankruptcy a lot sooner than most people anticipated.
Right. Let's talk a little bit more about this transforming the Islamic world. Did somebody have a plan to do that? Is it outlined somewhere? And where does it go from Iraq?
Well, I think that's a measure of the recklessness of the architects of this idea. They really didn't have a plan. What they had was a concept. They had a conviction of invincible American power. They had an ahistorical model of what we had done in Japan and Germany back in 1945, and they plunged into this global war on terror, basically, I think, believing that they could improvise the plan as it began to unfold. In other words, they didn't say, well, we're gonna invade and transform Iraq in 2003, and then 2004 we're going to move on to Syria, and then 2005 to Egypt. They figured that this demonstration of American power would be imposing, impressive, that it would really transform the power relationships. I was just reading yesterday on 9/11, as the Pentagon was burning, Donald Rumsfeld, then the Secretary of Defense, began to jot down some notes to himself about what needed to happen. And what he wrote to himself, just a little note, was, go massive. Sweep it all up, things related and not. Now, I think that that's a significant indicator of the kind of mindset that prevailed among the most influential members of the Bush inner circle. That wouldn't have been Colin Powell's response, but I think for people like Rumsfeld, for Vice President Cheney, for then Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, probably at that time for National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, go massive, sweep it all up, things related and not. That reflected the way they viewed the problem and how they intended to attack it.
And a question I almost hate to ask, but I will anyhow. You talk about prior to 9/11, the mission of Homeland Defense was really unassigned in this country. Can we talk more about that? And dare we entertain the question of, if it had been assigned, would we find ourselves in the state that we're in now?
Well, I don't think, I mean, arguably we would not. I mean, what I mean by that, so that your listeners understand, is that the organization, the institution called the Department of Defense, for decades now, really has not done defense. The mode of operations of the Department of Defense is global power projection. And the governing, I think, assumption is that we can best defend the country here by determining the course of events out there, whether out there is in Western Europe or Northeast Asia, or, as has increasingly been the focus of attention, the Persian Gulf and the greater Middle East. So almost nobody in our enormous Defense Department really was paying any attention to the need to defend the country, that is to say, the homeland, as we've come to call it. Arguably, if people in the Defense Department paid as much attention to defending the United States as they do to determining the course of events in places like South Korea, then perhaps on 9/11 we would have done a better job of identifying this conspiracy and of preventing it from coming to fruition.
Let's welcome phone calls for our guest. Our guest is the author of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. Professor Andrew Bacevich is with us, and he is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University, retired from the U.S. Army with the rank of colonel. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, also author of The New American Militarism, and has written for many esteemed publications. Our lines are all busy, but you can join us at 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls and start with Jim from Pleasant Prairie. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, and thank you so very much, especially to Colonel Bacevich for his seminal book. And I'm part of the way through it, and I've already recommended it to several other people that matter to me. And the points I wanted to make was, on the level of public discourse, I believe two things more than anything else have affected us negatively. One is the abuse of debt, which is now, as we currently speak, is coming to public attention, usually. The other thing is the mixture of religion and politics. To take it as a prime example, our foreign policy in the Middle East was based exclusively on oil, Israel, and the Soviet threat, and now it's the first two. The last has disappeared. But also, our internal problems, which are more difficult to affect, to illustrate, look what's happened to our sense of community, and look what's happened to our sense of family. When a culture goes into decline, the big question is, what is to be done? To quote Abraham Lincoln, if the Republic is ever to die, it won't be a a murder, it will be a suicide. Hmm. And anyway, I will listen to your response to my questions and comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, Jim said a lot there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems to me, one of the things I argue in the book is that the core of our problem, and I do think it's a core illustrated by the financial crisis on Wall Street, the core of our problem is that we have for too long as a people refused to live within our means. And the result of that has been ever greater debt, ever greater dependency. This refers to a dependency that is financial. It refers to a dependency that connects to things like energy, seemingly informed by an assumption that our line of credit will be endless. I mean, that the rules other nations have to play by don't apply to us. I argued in the book that that's not a sustainable proposition. I don't believe that it is. I fear that the events of the present moment are serving to affirm that conclusion. And so, as Jim was suggesting, I'm not sure that he and I would necessarily agree on all respects about things like religion and politics. But it does seem to me that the imperative of the moment is to clean up our own act, that we rather than trying to fix the world in order to accommodate the continuation of the American way of life, in many respects, that's what the global war on terror is, we really ought to try to fix the United States in order to ensure that the American way of life will be preserved. Now, there, of course, would be some people who would say, aha, This is the true agenda, isolationism. He wants to turn his back on the world. Not the point at all. I mean, I would argue that the United States has never been an isolationist country. It won't be. It can't be. But we can be, once again, a nation that tries to maintain some sort of balance between what we're trying to achieve in the world and the amount of power we have available to pursue those goals. We are vastly overextended economically and militarily, and that needs to be corrected.
Hmm. Let's go next to Habu from Madison. Hi, Habu.
Good morning to both of you, and thank you. Before I make my question, I'm really struck how our national debt, DEBT, seems to take a greater precedence in our consciousness than the death, DEATH, of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and all for nothing, meaning there was no, we were not threatened or anything. And this really means a realignment of our priorities and our humanity. As Americans, this whole thing seems like it's all around us. And I dare say that as bad as things may be in this country, people in Iraq have it 10 times worse, and all because of some kind of scheme. But that said, I'd like to ask your good guest, what do you think the American, not administration, but the American government owes the state of Iraq and the people of Iraq in way of reparations or fixing the infrastructure, et cetera? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Habu, for the call.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the problem, let's say, of infrastructure in Iraq is really a problem of an absence of money. I mean, there are substantial resources that are available to the Iraqi government today. Now that there has been some reduction of violence, and that there is a substantial export of oil, which until the last couple of weeks was actually quite expensive. You know, if people believe that that the United States has a moral obligation to the Iraqi people, I don't believe we owe any to the Iraqi state, then it seems to me that that debt needs to be acquitted through meaningful actions like allowing, let's say, the couple million of Iraqi refugees who are living in abysmal conditions in camps. Let them come to the United States of America and make their life here. Or if that's too much, then perhaps we should pay for those people in camps provide them shelter, provide them food, provide education for their children. Now, the fact of the matter is that's not going to happen because there are not sufficient numbers of American people who care enough about the plight of the Iraqi people in order to, let's say, admit a couple million as immigrants. So as a practical matter, and I regret to say this, as a practical matter, that kind of discussion is a theoretical one that won't ever, I think, have a meaningful place in our politics. Why is that? Well, because the reality is, maybe it's the unhappy reality, but it is the reality that the behavior of nations, any nation, You pick one, and it'll apply to that nation, is motivated primarily by perceived self-interest. There is no nation that behaves on an altruistic basis. And so when I talk, this goes back to his first point, when I talk about the problems of debt of the United States, I'm really trying to and I don't talk about the deaths of the Iraqis who have died as a result of our invasion. I'm trying to reflect my understanding of the way international politics actually works. It's only if we can perceive what our true self-interests are that we can begin to curb some of the tremendously destructive tendencies in our policies that have come to be especially evident in the past 7 years.
Our guest is Colonel Andrew Bacevich. His book is The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. And he joins us this hour here on the Ideas Network. I do want to tell you for Pledge, this is meaty stuff that's very important in this time that we're all alive. And we will continue with our conversation with him in just a moment. We are in a pledge drive right now. I'm Kathleen Dunn, as you probably know, and joining me in the studio is Rhonda Fanning, who produces this program, and we need to break for just a moment. Well, we're not, it's all part of the same thing. It's not a break, but we're here to ask for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. Your contribution makes the work of WPR possible, and it's very easy to make your donation. All you do is go online at WPR.org. or call toll-free 888-202-2552. Hello again, Rhonda.
Good morning, Kathleen. Our goal this hour is $9,000, and I want to remind everyone of that challenge grant from an existing member of an additional $1,000 once we reach that goal. We have about $8,000 yet to raise this hour, but we got about half the hour left. So make your pledge now so we can stay on track financially. Pledge now securely online at WPR.org or call toll-free at 888-202-2552.
And this is one of those special hours. As a special incentive, when you donate $150, you'll be able to receive a copy of Andrew's book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, which I believe is number three. If it's not number three, it's number two or number four, but I think it's number three in the New York Times bestseller list right now. So it's an important book for the times in which we live. Again, $150 contribution, and you will receive a copy of The Limits of Power.
You hear great guests like you are today all day long on the Ideas Network. We have 9.5 hours of locally produced call-in programs every day on Wisconsin Public Radio. What is that worth to you? This is a unique radio service in the nation, one of the most unique.
Yeah, and we ask you to send your contributions. It makes all of these programs that Rhonda mentioned, all of those hours possible. So pledge today for the service that you rely on online at WPR.org or call toll-free at 888-202-2552.
You can make your pledge any way you choose. You can call the toll-free number that Kathleen just gave you, or going to the web is really quick and easy. With a couple of clicks of your mouse, you can be on with the rest of your day. It doesn't take very much time at all. So please go to WPR.org and pledge securely through our website.
And if you're online now, some of you are, I'm sure you don't have to stop what you're doing. Almost, you don't have to stop. If you pledge online, you'll also be saving us the cost of sending you a reminder, and you save yourself the cost of a stamp, and you don't have to write a check, just WPR.org. It is that easy.
So let's keep working towards that goal of $9,000 that hour so we can get that challenge grant of the extra $1,000.
Thanks so much, Rhonda. We continue our conversation now with Colonel Professor Andrew Bacevich. His book is The Limits of Power. He's a professor of history and international relations at Boston University, retired from the U.S. Army with the rank of colonel, also author of The New American Militarism, and he has written for a number of publications and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you, Habu, so much for your call. We go next to Randy from Madison. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. If I can take a little exception with Colonel Bacevich, I think we did see a peace dividend. However, if you remember the sequence, the Soviet Union fell right about the same time that George Bush the Elder prosecuted the first Gulf War. And so we weren't going to be seeing it until some years later. Bill Clinton took office as the first president since Woodrow Wilson to not have the Soviet Union to contend with. And if you recall, under Bill Clinton, we had economic prosperity like we hadn't seen in decades, and we had a balanced budget, which was pretty much unprecedented for many decades. I would argue that we wouldn't have had any of that if we hadn't had the fall of the Soviet Union. I think that was our peace dividend.
Hmm. Colonel Bacevich?
Well, we're probably just going to have to agree to disagree. Here's the way I'd tell the story. It is absolutely true that at the end of the Cold War, there was a reduction of U.S. military forces. Round numbers, in the 80s, there were 2.1 million in active duty. After the Cold War, we went down to about 1.4 million in active duty. That process of reduction was actually begun by the elder Bush and then followed through by Clinton. Having said that, in the 1990s, defense spending stayed at or above $300 billion per year. The global deployment of U.S. military forces was adjusted to some degree, but essentially was sustained despite the end of the Cold War. And most importantly, the use of force began to become routine. Now, again, this began under the elder Bush. Remember, he intervened in Panama, Kuwait, and then Somalia. But that tendency was affirmed, very much affirmed, by Clinton, who upped the ante in Somalia, leading to the famous Mogadishu firefight, then intervened in Haiti, Bosnia, Kosovo, engaged in any number of minor clashes with the Iraqis, with Saddam Hussein, pummeled both Afghanistan and Sudan with cruise missiles. So it was Clinton who made the use of force routine, and it seems to me that to argue that somehow that decade constituted reaping a peace dividend is to very much misread, I think, the military history of the 90s.
And thanks very much for the call. I know this might be painful for you to talk about, but the personal becomes quite political and global in your case, Colonel. And that's your son. When we were talking about the number of Iraqis who have died, your son died in Iraq as well, didn't he?
Yeah, but I don't discuss that. I think that's a private matter.
Yeah.
I would just assume that it remained private.
Yeah, that's. I understand that. I'm just really sorry.
What
a hard thing. All right, let's go back to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. As you well know, and boy, do we ever know that we're in the middle of a presidential campaign. You do say in one part of the book that presidential campaigns are important, but maybe we're obsessed with them, and there may not be all that huge a difference in. Well, this one is perhaps more important than others, but considering the system that's in operation here, that maybe we're making too much of the possibility of great change with the election of someone new.
Yeah, I wouldn't want your listeners to conclude that I'm arguing that it really doesn't matter who wins. Obviously, it matters who wins, but I don't really think it matters nearly as much as in a sense the hype would seem to suggest. Let me illustrate the point, if I may. And it has to do with national security. The differences, I think, between McCain and Obama, like it or not, are coming down to be not strategic differences, not differences of fundamental policy. They're coming down to be differences of operational priority. In essence, to oversimplify only slightly, Senator McCain is arguing, elect me president because I know that Iraq is the central front in the global war on terror, and I'll win the war in Iraq. Senator Obama is saying, elect me, and I'll send more troops to Afghanistan, because Afghanistan is a central front in the global war on terror, and I'll be able to turn things around in Afghanistan. Now, that is an important difference, but it is a difference that, in a sense, is based on a common acceptance that the global war on terror makes sense as a way to frame U.S. national security policy. Personally, I think that the global war on terror is a deeply flawed way of framing our policy. A real election that involved real choice, to my mind, on this particular issue, would be an election in which one candidate was making the case for a global war on terror, for global war as the correct response to violent Islamic radicalism, and the opposing candidate was making the case that global war was a dumb idea, and that there was an alternative strategy that might allow us to achieve our purposes more effectively and more efficiently. But we don't hear that debate. So it's in that sense that I think that the expectations of change are being overstated.
Mm-hmm. Daniel from Rice Lake. Hi. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. Bush has resurrected Reagan's Star Wars mania. Even though there's virtually no reality to missile defense, the Russians have been enraged by Bush's plans to develop and deploy a missile defense system. Can you explain Bush's resurrection of Reagan's mad dreams for missile defense?
I would explain it in that it really has become part of the theology of the Republican Party. It has very little to do with a reasoned assessment of threat and of the technology involved. It is just one of those things that attributed to Reagan somehow. We have to follow through on that. I personally don't think it makes any sense at all. I think, in particular, the installation of ballistic missile defenses in Poland, ostensibly for the reason of protecting Europe from an ICBM attack by Iran, is especially ill-advised because it does have the result of unnecessarily, I think, alienating the Russians. We've been poking the Russians in the eye for the last 20 years with NATO expansion, with the interventions in the Balkans, with ballistic missile defense. They've poked us back, not justifying it. They've poked us back with the recent incursion into Georgia. What we need to do is to find a way to manage the Russian threat. It's a real threat. It's a modest threat. We need to manage that threat in ways that are not served by this installation of ballistic missile defenses in Poland.
Our guest is Colonel Andrew Bacevich. His book is The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. He's a professor of history and international relations at Boston University, retired from the U.S. Army with the rank of colonel, also author of The New American Militarism. Our phone number, thanks, Daniel, for your call, is 800-486-8655. More phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Turn to your phone calls now and let us go to Dave from Wanakee. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. I jumped in the middle of the show, so I'm hoping that this hasn't been asked. But it seems to me that American exceptionalism is just another way of saying might makes right. And if you were objectively looking at all these nations instead of having a patriotic feeling toward America, you just see it's just another in a long succession of empires in which the empirical authority said that we get to break the rules because we're special. And I don't really see any difference.
Colonel Bacevich?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a very important element of truth in what Dave just said. But the idea of exceptionalism is not simply that Mike makes right, but rather that the United States, Americans, we are called upon to perform a special mission in history, that our purposes are exalted purposes, and that because those purposes are exalted, therefore we should be allowed to exercise prerogatives that are not allowed to other people. Now, I personally think that this is an idea which is deeply pernicious, but it almost doesn't matter what somebody like myself might think. I think what's important for us to recognize is the extent to which this concept of American exceptionalism, of being different, of being special, is deeply hardwired into our collective psyche. And it is almost immune, I think, to contrary empirical evidence. And it really is, I think, to some degree, at the root of some of these problems in which we have blundered, especially with regard to foreign policy.
Thank you very much, Dave, for your call. We go to Vern next from Madison. Hi, Vern.
Hi. Professor Vasevich, you mentioned Reinhold Niebuhr in your book, and I realize it's a complex topic, and you can't take much time to do this, but would you say a few words about how Reinhold Niebuhr is relevant to our current situation?
Mm. He was prophetic,
well,
right?
For your listeners, Niebuhr was a Protestant theologian, public intellectual, man of great prominence in our public life in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and even into the 1960s. I believe that he is really one of the great prophets of our time. In helping us to discern the the dilemmas that we confront. I would urge your listeners, I hope your listeners will take a look at my book, but I would urge your listeners to take a look at Niebuhr's book, The Irony of American History, which he published back in 1952. It's just out in a new paperback edition. And it is, in my judgment, the most profound critical assessment of our foreign policy, and helps to understand how this concept of American exceptionalism both distorts the way we see ourselves and the way we see the world. It is a tremendously important book. So in my own work, I have used, I think, Niebuhr's insights as kind of a way of marking the trail that I'm trying to go down. I just admire his work, his legacy, tremendously, and think that he really is very much deserves to be revived in our present day.
Thank you, Vern, so much for the call. And let's go to a caller from Dubuque, Iowa. How do you pronounce your name?
Lalit.
Lalit, hi.
Yes. Hi. I want to ask the professor and many other people who talks about winning wars, how do you define winning a war? Is the number of people we kill, or how much we cripple the opponent? How do you define winning a war? What do we think that we have won a war?
Well, I think that most analysts of war or students of war would define winning or victory as imposing your will on the enemy in ways that enable you to achieve your political purposes. So killing, in many respects, really is ancillary. Now, people who think war is a usable instrument are not people who are particularly have a particularly humane point of view, but neither are they people who go to war because they're interested in seeing how much slaughter can occur. One of the great miscalculations of the Bush administration with Iraq was that they genuinely believed, they wrongly, stupidly, and recklessly, but genuinely believed that we would be able to invade and occupy and transform this country relatively quickly and relatively cheaply, both in terms of how much it would cost us financially and in terms of how much human suffering would result. I mean, they clearly got that entirely wrong. And I think the lesson from that is how difficult it is to anticipate what consequences will result when you opt to use force.
Mm-hmm. Professor Bacevich, thank you so much for being with us. I can see why the book is climbing the bestseller list, and it's amazing to me how many people are already reading your book. It's obviously an important one. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me on the program.
Our pleasure. Our guest, Colonel Andrew Bacevich, he is the author of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. He's a professor of history and international relations at Boston University, retired from the U.S. Army with the rank of colonel. And the book, I think, is number 3 on the bestseller list of the New York Times. For $150, we are very happy to send you this important work, and that's for a $150 pledge. I'm Kathleen Dunn. I'm joined in our studio now by Rhonda Fanning, who is producer of this program, and we're here to ask for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. As you know, it's your contribution to us that keeps all this work possible, and it's very easy to make your donation. You go online at WPR.org, or you can call toll-free at 888-202-2552. Hello again, Rhonda.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
That's right. We have a goal this hour of $9,000 plus that extra challenge grant from an existing member of an additional $1,000 when we meet that $9,000 goal. We are kind of far from that goal. We still have about $7,000 to raise. So be the next person to call in and pledge your support to Wisconsin Public Radio. You can do it in one of two ways. You can go on our secure website. It takes just a few seconds at WPR.org. Or you can give one of our volunteers a call at 888-202-2552.
As you know, most broadcast media takes about a minute or less than a minute to tell a story. You can't tell a story in a minute. Wisconsin Public Radio has time, and that's so precious, the time that we need to bring you a huge story, whether it's The Limits of Power and American Exceptionalism, which is a conversation we just had, or what's going on politically, you hear about the topics that affect your life, and it's long. It's long conversation. It's more than just a little minute. It's an hour, which is pretty remarkable, right, Rhonda?
That's right. And speaking of hours, this hour only, you can get Andrew Bacevich's book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, for a pledge of $150 this hour. $150 is going to get you a copy of the book, and it's also going to get us one step closer to that $9,000 goal, and we're going to receive that extra $1,000 from the existing member, that challenge grant. So please make your pledge of support now securely online at WPR.org or toll-free at 888-202-2552. You can make your pledge payment using a credit card. You can pay the entire pledge at once or set up monthly installments. It's totally up to you. Use your MasterCard, your Visa, Discover, American Express. Toll-free 888-202-2552, and you can rest assured that we never share your information with other organizations or anyone else.
That's right. And I'm sure that many of you know that Wisconsin Public Radio is very important in your lives. If you can ask yourself a question right now, would you miss it if it weren't here? Would you miss all of these wonderful daily conversations? Well, I would imagine that you probably said, yes, you would miss it. I would miss it. Yeah, we all would miss it. And that says a lot. We're not going anywhere. But if your answer is yes, that means that you are a Wisconsin Public Radio fan, that you rely on Wisconsin Public Radio, that Wisconsin Public Radio is certainly worth your pledge of support. So again, give us a call. The number is 888-202-2552. 888-202-2552. Or you can also go online and you can pledge at WPR.org. You can go online and pledge at WPR.org. We'll make it very easy for you. And we certainly do appreciate all of your support.
In our home all the time. It's on in our cars. It's the first thing I listen to in the morning. It's usually the last thing I hear before I go to bed. For me, not listening to it would be like not eating. It's a part of my world, and it's something that I can't live without. I'm Christy from Wausau, and Wisconsin Public Radio is my source for music, news, and everything in between.
Again, the pledge number is 888-202-2552. We have a goal of $9,000 for this hour, and we have a way to go to get there, but your pledge will help us reach that goal and stay on track financially. So please make your pledge now, and they can do that how, Rhonda? They can go
You can go online at WPR.org and pledge securely through our website, or you can give one of our volunteers a call at 888-202-2552. And for this hour only, when you call and pledge at that $150 level, you are going to receive a copy of The Limits of Power by Andrew Bacevich, The End of American Exceptionalism. Again, this book is extremely important. It's on the New York Times bestseller list. I know a lot of you already have the book, but maybe you want to pledge your support this hour and give a copy of the book to a friend or a loved one.
And you can do so by calling 888-202-2552. Andrew Bacevich talks about the use of the American military. He talks about our being overextended. He talks about the role of America in the world right now. And we talk about these kind, where else do you get those kinds of conversations? Who else talks about those topics that are so incredibly important? This is the caliber of guests that you hear virtually every day on Wisconsin Public Radio, and you have access to the people like this and the information they provide. Think about what kind of how the contribution makes your life better, which is pretty easy to think about, and then make your pledge online at WPR.org or call toll-free at 888-202-2552.
WPR is listener-supported. You can help support Wisconsin Public Radio by pledging online now at WPR.org. Give any amount that's comfortable for you. Some give $60 a year, some $1,000. You decide. Whatever the amount, we'll use your contribution to help pay the costs of broadcasting so you'll stay informed, enlightened, and entertained for the next year. Join. Become a member, Wisconsin Public Radio at WPR.org, or you can give us a call at 888-202-2552 right now with your pledge.
And we want to remind you, we have a $9,000 goal, but we also have a challenge grant, right, Rhonda? So we get
That's an extra $1,000. That extra $1,000 once we reach that goal of $9,000 from an existing member who is so kind to make this challenge. So let's get there. We have a couple of minutes left to reach that goal of $9,000, and we're not quite there yet. So please call now. $150 is going to get you a copy of Andrew Bacevich's book, The Limits of Power.
Thanks very much, Rhonda, and thanks to all of you who have pledged this hour and pledged during our pledge drive. We really are happy for your support, and you keep us going strong. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour, and thank you, everybody, for all of your pledge of support. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. We'll join you again tomorrow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.